Have you all had access to the notes in, I don't know, are they in the wiki? Where the, yeah. So I hope they're useful. They kind of contain almost exactly the same material that we discussed. So today we start our journey in trying to understand what is a quantum phase. And again, let me stress that our goal is the following. Whereas in high energy physics or in fundamental physics, when we think about, you know, electrons and protons, every property of an electron is absolutely important. Okay? There are not things that are more important than others. And all electrons are exactly the same. It's not like you have two electrons that are a bit different. And the same with protons. And everything that distinguishes an electron from a proton is absolutely important. When we have many body systems and emergent properties, the situation is much more complicated. I give you two pieces of iron, and they are the same. It's iron. But if you look at them very carefully, they are not exactly the same. There are defects in the crystalline structures that are not exactly the same. There are impurities that are not exactly the same. So in some sense, they are different. In some sense, they are the same, because they are both iron. And they are the very same if you compare them with a piece of another material, of, say, copper. So you see that when we talk about emergent properties, now we have this notion that there is something that is important and something that is not important. So in some sense, some properties, like exactly where the defects are, seems to be not an important property. That doesn't change the fact that iron is iron, whereas some other properties are important. So the definition of what a phase is the recognition of what is important. And in quantum many-body theory, this is a world that we are understanding in these years. So as a first guidance to understanding what is a quantum phase and what are quantum phase transitions, we will start with a review of these notions in classical physics. We will start using them as a guidance, and it will be very fruitful. Then at some point, we will see that we need something more. That's not enough. Quantum phases are richer than classical phases. OK, so you have all taken statistical mechanics. And so I will ask you some questions. Help me out here. So in classical statistical mechanics, what defines what are the important quantities? In fact, there is one important, really fundamental quantity from which everything else is derived. It's a macroscopic quantity. Almost. So it's not just the energy.
Free energy.
It's the free energy. Very good. So the free energy is our macroscopic quantity. And this is the partition function of the system. And you know that you can derive all you want, I mean, all that is important from this quantity. All the considerations we made yesterday about the existence of a thermodynamic limit are valid. In fact, yesterday I think I mostly talked about classical energy. So therefore, they're valid especially for classical statistical mechanics. So what is important is that the free energy density, which is this object, is well defined. Okay? This must not diverge. And pretty much what we said yesterday about the energy is all that matters. Okay? So it's for the divergence of this object is energy the problem, not the entropy. So we are fine. If the thermodynamic limit for the free energy exists, for the free energy density exists, we can take the thermodynamic limit. Now there is a theorem that says that if this object exists, so we can do statistical mechanics, then it is always analytic, but for a set of codimension one. What do I mean? What I mean is this. This free energy density will depend on some macroscopic quantities, like, say, for instance, pressure, volume, temperature, whatever that is. Okay? And I'm claiming that in this space of parameters, this splits in domains of analysity for the free energy. So, for instance, if I just consider a PT diagram, the number of points in which the free energy may be non-analytic is codimension one, which means, if since this is 2D, only lines, something like that. Okay? If we have a three-dimensional parameter space, codimension one means surfaces, so it's always analytic, but on some surfaces. And in classical statistical mechanics, we say that phases are domains of analysity of the free energy density. Okay? So you have phase one, phase two, phase three. And these lines in where you change phases and that are marked by the fact that the free energy density is non-analytic are called points of phase transition. Okay, so far so good. Let's take an example. Let's take as an example the closest thing to what we showed yesterday, that is the classicalizing model. Okay, so again, we have a lattice or a graph, and we have something like this. So we have a coupling on the links of our lattice, and then we have a field. And look, this looks very similar to what I wrote yesterday when I wrote the quantumizing model, except that these objects here are not operators, but they are numbers. They're called Ising spins. They're just numbers that can have the value plus or minus one. Okay, so this is a classical model. Notice that it's not just the fact that I write numbers instead of operators that really makes it classical. Imagine that I wrote this model in this way. You see, so now they are operators. Okay? Would this make, and somehow these operators also have two values, two possible values every time you measure them, right? It's either plus one or minus one. So definitely, I can write the same Hamiltonian that has exactly the same physics using the language of operators instead of that of numbers. There is no difference. So it is not just the fact that I use operators instead of numbers that makes it quantum. So this is a classical model. And now I can ask you the question, what makes it classical, not quantum? In spite of the fact that there are operators. Why the one I showed yesterday is quantum?
Computation relations?
Please speak louder.
Commutation relations?
Yes, so can you elaborate a bit? Yes, that's exactly the point.
The polymatrices don't commute?
The polymatrices in the model of yesterday do not commute, whereas these all commute. So this means that all the eigenstates of this model are just given spin configurations. There are no superpositions. So you don't need to do a superposition of different spin configurations to make an eigenstate. So even if I use the language of Brian Katz, but I don't use superposition, you know, that's just a fancy language, but it has exactly the same physics than the language of numbers. So very good, yes. Okay, so this is our classical model. So there are no superpositions. We just have spin configurations. And the given spin configuration will be indicated by this, okay? So this means that I have chosen the value of sigma plus or minus 1 for every spin in my model. Okay. And, okay, so now let's play a little bit with this thing. And let us take the first derivative with respect to the magnetic field. This is called the magnetic field of the free energy density. Okay, so what is that you have to do? We have 1 over n, this thing. So this is 1 over n, and then here we have minus kT. So let me write it like in this way. And the partition function, of course, Z, is given by the sum over all the spin configurations of this. Notice that H is a function of a spin configuration. Given a spin configuration, this is a number. So this is a function of my spin configurations. This is the partition function. Okay, so probably many of you are very familiar with this. So somebody wants to tell me what is the result of this calculation, or you want me to do it? Are you familiar with this or not? Okay, good. Very good. Okay, so we just need to, you know, take this derivative where Z is this object. Okay, so we have the log of this. So what we have here is 1 over n. Then we have Z. And then we have, since I'm differentiating with respect to this, we have a beta that comes down and cancels this one. And then we have the sum over all the configurations of this object. And again. Okay? So now we call the sum of all the values of sigma I on every spin, we call it magnetization M. And notice that, okay, so now look at this. So apart, we have 1 over n, then anything else is this function that is a function of our configurations, right? For every configuration, we have a given magnetization. And then we have 1 over z, the sum of all the configurations, this times this weight that you recognize as the Boltzmann probability, the Boltzmann distribution. Okay, so what is the sum of something times the probability over all the configurations? The average. Okay, so this is the average magnetization per site, which we call this. And if you solve, say, this model on a square lattice, and you plot this object, and we will kind of some of you that have done classical statistical mechanics and the transfer matrix method have probably solved it in 1D. But if you solve it in 2D, which is something that we can learn by doing the quantum one, and then there is a mapping to the classical one. But if we plot this guy here as a function of the temperature, okay, so we see something like this. So we have T on the x-axis over some critical value, let me call it critical value of the temperature, Tc. And here we have M, the average. And when T is equal to Tc, so for this equal to 1, we have something like this. So we notice that this object has a derivative here that is diverging, right? And in turn, because this is the first derivative of the free energy density, this means that the second derivative of the free energy density is discontinuous. Okay? Yeah?
You said this is in 2D? This is for the 2D case?
This is for the 2D case. In the 1D case, there are no phase transition at finite temperature. So this is for the 2D case. Actually, also for higher dimensions case. But whatever I'm going to say is valid for the 2D case. OK. So what I'm saying is that we have a discontinuity of the derivative of M, which is a discontinuity in the second derivative of the free energy density. That's why this is called a continuous phase transition. Anywhere else but this point, the free energy is completely analytic. So that's why here we have two phases. Phase one, phase two. And this phase is characterized by the fact that this quantity is identically zero, so there is no magnetization, and we call it paramagnetic, whereas here, magnetization is different from zero. It's not constant, but it's different from zero, so there is some spontaneous magnetization, and we call it spontaneous magnetization because this is true even if we compute this at a zero field. So of course, there is no wonder that if you have some external field, then the spins align. But even if the field is zero, then you have this profile. So it's called spontaneous magnetization. Because this quantity, which is, by the way, look, it's a local quantity, because it's the sum of just local objects. This takes two types of different values in the two phases, identically zero or non-vanishing. Because of this, this is called local order parameter and distinguishes the two phases. Okay? Okay, so this is the first thing we learned. Second thing. So we claimed, I mean, because, you know, this comes out from the exact solution, that the second derivative is diverging. Okay? So let's see what the second derivative looks like. So let's just compute it. This is what I'm doing, and then I send the field to zero. Okay? This is the second derivative of the free energy density. So now I have to take the derivative of this object that is this object. Okay. And now you see what is the trick. The trick is that every time I differentiate something, I have to play with this beta that come down and things like that. So let me do that. Okay, so here we have, first of all, we have overall 1 over n. And I will get a beta now, because that will not cancel with the 1 over beta that we had before. Okay. And, okay, so when I differentiate this, so let me first differentiate this one, sorry, this part. I will have 1 over z, and then I will have again this sum. And now I will have this term coming down again, which will give me a m squared. E to the minus beta h. And now I differentiate this one, which gives me minus 1 over z squared. Let me write just z. And then I have to multiply again for this, so I get a square. Okay. Well, and now you see what this is. This is the average of m squared minus the average of m squared. That is, these are the fluctuations of m, of the total magnetization. This is a very paradigmatic example of the so-called fluctuation dissipation theorem. It relates the response of the system to an external perturbation. Right? I wiggle a little bit the external field with the fluctuations of the system. Okay? So what is that we learn? What happens at the critical point here? At the critical point, we said this object is diverging, is very, very large. Okay? Exactly at the critical point is infinite. Near the critical point is growing very fast. And this means that the fluctuations are very large. Okay? So magnetization fluctuates a lot. What does it mean? Fluctuates in what sense? In the temporal sense? What kind of fluctuations am I talking about here?
Statistical.
Statistical, given by the probability distribution of the boson probability distribution. The very fact that we are at finite temperature just means that. Temperature means things fluctuate. Every time I measure them, there is a probability of being what they are. And the fluctuations are very large for magnetization near the critical point. Okay, so let me pull this up. Okay, so let me see what I want to say. Oh, okay. Similarly, there are other quantities that are like this. So if you compute the fluctuations of energy, which are therefore this quantity, E minus the average of E squared, this is the same thing than writing something like that, of course. This is equal to the second derivative of the free energy with respect to the temperature. Okay? So you see that fluctuations are very large at the critical temperature. And they are large in the sense of the ensemble fluctuations that are given by the probability distribution, that is the Boltzmann probability distribution, that depends on the temperature. For this reason, we say that classical phase transitions are driven by temperature. Okay, there is a critical temperature. Okay. Now, an interesting we said that yesterday that we want to understand phase transitions from the point of view of correlations. Okay, in general, of quantum correlations. Quantum correlations are very rich. There are many types of correlations. There is entanglement. But in classical statistical mechanics, the most important correlations are given by correlation functions, Cij. These are the so-called connected correlation functions that are just this. So if I have a local order parameter, like for instance sigma I, I consider this object, the average of this product minus this thing. A two-line calculation shows that this is equal to the difference between omega I and its average times the difference between omega j and its average on average. So these are the fluctuations at I, these are the fluctuations at j, and these are the average fluctuations, the average correlations between the fluctuations on two different sites. Solution of the Ising model shows that this object decay in this way. And psi is called correlation length. Correlation length will be a very important object for the rest of this course. Notice that, now look at the top, at the thing. Remember that M is the sum over I of sigma I. So if I insert that in there, what I find is that my dm over dh, which is called susceptibility, I forgot to tell you, magnetic susceptibility is equal to something like this. So let's see. In other words, each of these objects is a correlation function. See? This term is this term, and this term is this term because these objects are equal at every site. So, if we have a system that is translational invariant, what we can do is to take a specific j that we call zero and replace the sum over j with the volume of the system that is n, so that we have a beta, the sum just over I of sigma I sigma zero minus sigma zero. I can do it like this. Which is the sum of the correlation functions with respect to a specific point zero, but this specific point is okay because the system is translational invariant, so all the points are the same. Now, since each of these objects decays in this way, if I bound the value of each of them within xi by s square, a square, so this can be bounded by beta, a square, and then the number of the volume of xi. The volume of xi is xi to d, the number of special dimensions. So this can be upper bound in this way. Very well. Okay, so now let's revisit what it means to have large fluctuations at the critical point, which means diverging susceptibility in the view of this. This means, if this is diverging, it means that psi is diverging, right? Because this is a number. Here we have r at finite temperature. Psi is diverging. So a phase transition means that fluctuations are very large, or susceptibility is very large, or correlation length is very large. In other words, fluctuations at different sites are correlated all over the system. You see also another thing, that if xi is diverging, so if this number becomes infinite and we plug it in here, this object, when this is very large, cannot be anymore an exponential. In fact, you can do it as an exercise. In the limit of this going to infinity, this must become a power law, and becomes a power law of the type so you have some exponent here. This exponent depends on the details on how xi diverges with as you approach the critical temperature. So when you solve the system, or numerically you compute it, and it's called the critical exponent. Okay, so you see, this means that these correlation functions are diverging at the critical point. One of the beautiful things of critical phenomena is that these gammas are universal. What does it mean? That if I modify a little bit my Hamiltonian within reason, but there is a whole class of systems that have a phase transition, and the phase transition in these correlation functions, they have all exactly the same critical exponent. Okay, so this is one of the signs of the fact that we are talking about a phase, something that does not depend on the microscopic details of our system. It is universal. I said that psi also has to diverge, and xi is found to diverge in this way, and we call nu the critical exponent for the divergence of xi. Okay. Very good. So in these 30 minutes, we basically reviewed all we need for the continuation of this course to know from classical phase transitions, okay? So the key elements is that there is something that we so far call phase, that is the domain of analyticity of the free energy density. Then the other message that we got is that these phases are distinguished by something called the local order parameter. And the third thing is that at the critical point, in this point where our free energy density is not analytic anymore, you have large fluctuations and diverging correlation length. Okay, so these are the three messages that you need to retain to continue. So now let's talk about a quantum system. Okay. So in a quantum system, we want to somehow translate again these notions in a quantum system. And we want to understand, again, what it is to have large fluctuations, because having large fluctuations is what marks that we have some kind of phase transition. But now we have a difficulty, because when we do quantum mechanics, fluctuations can come up in two different ways, right? So you could have a pure state, psi, and then in this pure state gives you a probability distribution, right? For the outcomes of the measurements of a given operator O, and for instance, the average will be given by the expectation value. But this is one given pure state. Or you could be in a mixed state, right? This means that you have the state psi I with the probability pi. And for instance, this probability could be the Boltzmann probability. So this would be the energy associated to this state, the expectation value of the energy in this state. So you see that now, well, okay, now when I want to compute the average of O in a state that is mixed, now this is inheriting fluctuations that are due to the fact that I don't know in what state I am. And once I know in what state I am, also there is a probability. Here the probability would be the probability of having the outcome k of my, so let me write it properly. My observable O can be diagonalized, and in its diagonal basis we'll have some eigenvalues that are the possible outcomes of experiments, and then it will have eigenstates. This is, of course, called the spectral resolution. So the probability of finding the value of omega k is, of course, given by psi k modulus square, right? So now you have somehow to mix both these types of probability. So can you tell me, so the average that takes in account both, how I write it? How do I take in account both this and this?
Are we using finite temperature or not?
Yes. Yeah, I'm at a finite temperature, that's why BPI has this probability, right?
Isn't that just a trace of the density matrix times the e to the minus?
It is, yeah, you are close, but it is the trace of rho, of O in a density matrix psi. And what is this density matrix psi? Just is a way to encode this information, is just the sum over all my possible psi I. So you see, it is not a pure state. It is a matrix with probability pi. So this expectation value takes in account both this probability, because it is inside psi, And this probability, because for every psi I, when I take the trace, I have to sandwich O with psi I, right? Okay. So why I'm saying all this? Because to the extent that we want to understand the quantum phases, we do not want to look at ensemble fluctuations that depend on temperature. Because otherwise, we don't know if we're talking about a phase transition that comes from the quantum fluctuations. It could, but maybe it's there because of the thermal fluctuations, or maybe both. In fact, you cannot really separate them. So we only want to look at large fluctuations that come only from the fact that we are in a quantum state. So we want this to be a trivial probability distribution. We don't want to have uncertainty coming from the fact that we have this probability distribution. So how do we do that? When is that this becomes a trivial probability distribution, that we have probability one of being in one state and zero being anywhere else?
Zero.
When the temperature is zero, so the limit of beta going to infinity here, you see it's exactly this. We have probability one of being in the ground state. And in the case the ground state is non-degenerate, it means a pure state. If it's degenerate, it's a projector onto that subspace. But in any case, unless the degeneracy is extensive, you don't have many fluctuations due to the fact that you have many states there. And they at zero everywhere else. So at the zero temperature, we are in the ground state. So quantum phase transitions are transitions that happen in the ground state. Okay? So this has two bearings on our description. First of all, that whatever we meant about the non-analysity of the free energy density, because we are at zero temperature, becomes a non-analyticity in the ground state energy density. Okay? So we will say that quantum phases are domains of analysity of the free the ground state energy density. Second question is, a domain in what space? Right, so it's a domain there with our a space could be PTV. Here, what is our domain? It's not T, right? There is not T. T is frozen to zero. So the domain is given by this. If you remember, our Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators, right? Now, we can have this Hamiltonian be a smooth family of some parameters lambda. So lambda here is a vector of parameters, it's many parameters. The manifold of these parameters is called parameters manifold of the model. In the quantumizing model we showed yesterday, we have only one parameter, that is a G. You remember? Our Hamiltonian was minus gj sigma x minus j, the sum over all the links of our lattice, sigma z I, sigma z j. And here j is not really a parameter because it doesn't change anything, it's just an energy scale. Okay, so the In this case, this is a model with one parameter. And as you can see, the Hamiltonian is smooth in G. Because G is here, it's linear in G. So I can differentiate as many times as I want. Theorem, if a matrix, any matrix, not just an Hermitian operator, but if any normal matrix is smooth in some parameters, all its eigenvalues are continuous, but not necessarily all its eigenvalues are analytic. So some derivatives can be discontinuous. The eigenvalues themselves are continuous. So the first derivative, say, of the ground state energy could be discontinuous. So this one could be discontinuous. Or this one could be discontinuous. Or higher order derivatives could be discontinuous. In this case, these are called the first order phase transitions. From this point on, they're called continuous phase transitions. And what do they look like? So the first thing I want to say that at least for what we are concerned right now, these phase transitions are trivial. Sometimes they're not trivial, but typically they're trivial. And the reason is that, let me give you an example of a Hamiltonian that has that phase transition. Okay, let me use another blackboard. Imagine I have this Hamiltonian. So I have an energy zero, lambda, and then a state zero, plus another energy E1, one minus lambda, another state that is orthogonal, plus any other orthogonal terms. Are you familiar in writing Hamiltonians in this way? As the sum of projectors? Okay. So now if we plot the energy, this energy, and this energy, so the energy of the ground state and of the first excited state as a function of lambda, right? This is exactly what I wrote. This is epsilon 0 lambda. This is epsilon 1, 1 minus lambda. So this value is epsilon 0. This one value is epsilon 1. Well, strictly speaking, the ground state energy is there for this one, right? So you see that here the first derivative is discontinuous because here is positive and here is negative. From left is positive. From left is negative. So level crossing is a way of making this object discontinuous. But why level crossing is trivial? From our point of view. Of a many-body system.
Anti-crossing.
No, it's because you see, even if you have just a two-level system, one particle, a two-level system, it can happen. See, imagine we have a very small dimensional Hilbert space. There is nothing many-body here. There is nothing emergent. There is nothing universal. Okay, so that's why. At least for the goals of this course, we don't look at these things. We only look at continuous phase transitions in which this one is discontinuous. And the mechanism is this, in which you have ground state energy that does like this, and the first excited energy that does like this. And here you have a gap that we call delta E. And at the critical point, this gap closes. but only closes in the thermodynamic limit. So in the limit of this parameter going to the critical one, this object goes to zero and in the thermodynamic limit. So only in this case. For every finite system, there is a gap. However, this gap, when you are in the wannabe critical point, will have a finite size scaling that could be 1 over n or a 1 over n to the alpha, or could be exponentially small. So these are all different ways of having a vanishing gap at the critical point. Okay? So our first picture about quantum phases and quantum phase transitions will be this. We have a model defined by a certain number of parameters. The energy of the ground state will be analytic everywhere in this manifold, but on a set of codimension one, just like there. At these points, the gap between the ground state and the first excited state will vanish. And in turn, this will imply that this derivative is discontinuous. Okay, so this is our first picture. We need to understand at this point if what happens to correlation functions. Okay? When we will solve this model exactly, we will also see, at least as a result, not all the details of the calculations, but we will at least give a sketch of this result that I want to anticipate here, that again, all correlation functions decay like in the same way, but at the critical point, so when lambda is very close to lambda critical, then psi diverges in this way, which means that the correlation functions then will decay algebraically with a power law, just like before. So nothing has changed. We will see this as a result of the exact solution of this quantum model. And we will see another thing, that there is a relationship between the gap between the ground state and the first excited state and this quantity. The relationship is the following, that delta is equal to delta to the minus one, delta E to the minus one is equal to psi to the z. That is, it goes like lambda minus lambda c to the minus nu z. So nu and z are the critical exponents that are important in quantum phase transitions, at least those that we care about. And also they are universal. So if we have slight deformations of the quantumizing model, for instance, we include next near neighbors interactions, we still have the same quantum phase transition with the same critical exponents. We also notice another thing, that there is a connection between the vanishing of the gap and correlation length. So correlation length is the inverse of that. Those of you who have taken quantum field theory may recognize this, right? That this is like the mass gap. Right? The first excited state is the mass of the quasi-particles or of the particles in quantum field theory. And the correlation length is the expectation has to do with how fast it decays this correlation function. But what is that correlation function? It's the probability of finding a particle at J if you create it at I. So it's like the propagator. So that's why when you have a mass, the propagator decays exponentially. So we have a counterpart in statistical mechanics of this quantum field theory thing. Okay? So we will see some of the details of these things from the exact solution of the Ising model. We definitely will get to compute the gaps, and we'll give a sketch of how to compute correlation functions. The complete calculation to compute the correlation functions is very long and tedious, so we'll not have the time to go through every single detail, but I will give you references for those that are interested. But we will get to the exact solution of the model. Okay. Are there questions? So in the second part of this lecture that we'll do just before the tutorial, we will start to examine the different phases of the quantumizing model and give a first argument to understand why, first of all, why there should be a critical point, and second, to locate it. So for which value of G you have the phase transition. Okay? Then during the tutorial, we will learn how to compute the gap at every order in perturbation theory. So we will use perturbation theory to determine the phases, the point of quantum phase transitions. We will see perturbation theory is, in fact, very powerful for this kind of things. Okay, so I think we have a few more minutes, and but it's too little to start the next topic that I want to introduce, which will be in the second part of the lecture. But maybe if you have some questions about anything, I would be very happy to take them. Yes?
So you said that in this figure, there's a second, so the second derivative is discontinuous. How can we see it? Just by.
No, so that figure is M. That I talk about. You're saying talking about this.
Just by looking at this figure, can we see it?
So the proof is not elementary. This implies that some derivative must be discontinuous, not just the second one. Some higher order derivative must be discontinuous. Qualitatively, if when this gap closes, okay, really closes, so this means that, okay, here the first derivative, as you can see, is continuous. But maybe some higher derivative, if you differentiate this, at some point, one of the higher derivatives, because you are changing, for instance, the inflection, right? So this means that one of the higher derivatives must have a cusp. Pretty much that is. So which derivative depends on the exact shape of that curve?
So it doesn't really matter if it's the second or a higher order derivative is just.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter. There was a time where people thought that it mattered, and they would distinguish between second, third, fourth order phase transitions. But this distinction has not proven useful And so we just talk about continuous phase transitions from that point on. Yeah?
Why is it that we use that terminology? You said that the first diagram with the first order discontinuity is a continuous phase transition or discontinuous?
So here the first derivative is discontinuous. And from now on, all the first derivative is continuous. And that's why we use this terminology. But yeah, it's just terminology. So. And the point, we distinguish this from this because this does not involve divergence of correlation length, because divergence of correlation length can only happen in the thermodynamic limit because you must have extensive fluctuations. So there is nothing that becomes, you know, involves all the system that only happens in thermodynamic limit. It can happen in a trivial system like the one that I exampled above. So that's why we don't really care about. But I'm hesitating because, of course, there are phase transitions in which sometimes some of this level crossing do happen only in the thermodynamic limit, so they're interesting. And or there are multicritical points in which you have both things at the same time. So of course, things there are always situations in which things get much more complicated. And you know, we are starting simple now. Okay, so see you in a little bit.